Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff. Today, host Keith Brown Ill talks with local activist Lamar Vickers about his nephew, Victor Vickers, whose proof of innocence has not freed him because his defense did not follow court rules to the letter. Then, host Margot Patterson talks with architect Andy Couples about the art and science of designing prisons and jails and how that design can create a humane and supportive atmosphere. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. Now, Keith Brown Ill and his guest.
Today on Jaws of Justice Radio, we bring you yet another story about a person victimized by the corruption in the Jackson County criminal justice system. Victor Vickers is serving life without parole for first-degree murder, first-degree assault, and armed criminal action, all crimes which he maintains he did not commit back on August 16, 2011, and insists that the evidence in the case failed to prove. I have here in the studio with me Lamar Vickers, who is a well-known community activist here in Kansas City. Lamar is here to enlighten us and our listening audience about the situation regarding his nephew, which took place 8 years ago, and who is currently still seeking to have his convictions overturned. Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
Good morning.
Okay, we've already got started trying to give the listening audience a little bit of information about your nephew's case. Can you start from the beginning and kind of like, you know, enlighten us as to how all this came into play and what's, you know, currently taking place with his situation and what he's done so far as far as trying to exonerate himself on these charges?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. And we'll start with the fact that when they were first accused, we as a family and them went to and said, look, you know, I'm standing for the fact that if you accuse, you turn yourself in. I done advocated against families harboring their children like that.
Exactly.
So we encouraged them. You innocent? Okay, go. They go. They turn themselves in willingly.
How old was he at the time?
This was 8 years ago. So I would put him at 23, 24.
And he'd never been involved in any trouble or had any kind of...
No violent nothing in all of his life. And as a matter of fact, he was more of the peacemaker.
When situations like that came up.
Situations like that. And so that's why it was easy for us to believe that he was innocent.
Right.
So we said, okay, now, you go turn yourself in. So he go turn himself in. He gets a paid lawyer. They start preparing for the case. And we start off with the fact that his right to a speedy trial was the first thing that was breached. They were prepared, and because of the fact that the prosecutor had dismissed the case, and it was was delayed to gain tactical advantage.
Right.
And that was the first thing. So now, through the delay process and all that, where he started off with a paid attorney, he ended up with a public defender.
Okay.
That was, in essence, the thing that hurt him the most. So now we go to the actual case itself.
Right.
You know, it was amazing that I'm sitting there in the courtroom listening to this information that I'm getting ready to reveal, and they did not dismiss this with reasonable doubt. Let's start with this. The eyewitness, the girl who was the guy got killed, she was attempted murder on her.
Right.
This girl been knowing him for years. But yet, when the 911 call that they have an audio of that wasn't able to be presented, that says, who did this to you? And she said, I don't know. Mm-hmm. How you not going to know in a time like that? When you, as the his lawyer said in the video, when you fearing at that point for your life, you said you can't move, but yet you don't know who did this? That's the most damaging bit of evidence that should have brought reasonable doubt.
I would think that if you're in a situation like that and you looking into the face of somebody who you think is getting ready to kill you, that you wanted to be able to know who that person is.
That's, you know? And so that's the biggest contention. Now you go further, and that same girl, right, who also had DNA of the guy in her nail, that same girl says they were driving a silver car. Well, there was an eyewitness. And all her statements, the eyewitness had a different account. Take, for instance, this one. She said that it was a silver car. The eyewitness said it was a white car. The car she identified was searched. There was no DNA, no evidence, no nothing.
This is the silver car.
This is the silver car that she attached to this. But yet the eyewitness said it was a white car.
Right.
She says that they had long hair. The eyewitness said it was short. All these different accounts that was...
This is only one eyewitness they had.
Only one. And the one eyewitness that was named in the family submitted a report. This eyewitness was named in the family's report as being questionable.
Well, was Victor able to give an account of where he was? If he wasn't there at the location where the crime occurred, he had to be somewhere else.
And guess what? That witness was never allowed to testify.
Okay.
And they said it was because that the public defender did not present.
List him as a witness. He
had, yeah.
He had to get a prosecutor
in a timely
notes.
Manner.
Right.
So the prosecutor says, no, we're not. It's too late. We're not hearing that. That right there was the most damaging act and breach of this judicial system that took place because he was entitled to that.
Was there a problem locating the witness?
No.
Or did they know about him from the very beginning?
They said, you didn't present this in the proper amount of time, so we're not accepting it.
Well, did Victor give the name of the witness to the lawyer in a timely manner?
Yes.
Okay, and so this wasn't newly discovered evidence. It was known from the time that the crime was supposed to be had committed. Well, it was committed,
yes.
But at the time that Victor was supposedly had committed the crime.
And there's a video where the his previous paid attorney describes it as public defenders have enormous caseload.
Right.
But yet, that caseload should not be the reason that a person is sitting in jail wrongfully accused of a murder they didn't commit.
Well, this is one of the reasons why I insist on the idea that there's a lot of corruption in the system, because one person can only do so much. If you give him a overwhelming amount of cases,
right,
he is simply not going to be able to devote the necessary time to trying to work on those cases. Now, I'm not making excuses for what was done in his case, but they give the prosecutors enough money and enough staff members,
right,
to be able to meet the demands of the caseload. That's not the case with the public defenders, and they had a situation that was going on here. I don't know what became of it here in Jackson County not long ago, where all the public defenders, they were making a lot of noise about this. And matter of fact, they had all assembled in the courtroom or something. I had read something on the internet where they had all assembled in the courtroom to try to, protest that they were being underfunded. That's another trick of the judicial system. You know, they don't give you, if you can't afford an attorney, they give you one of their attorneys. And basically all these public defenders can do, the only thing they're prepared for is to try to negotiate some kind of plea agreement with you. If you get ready to go to trial, then you're in trouble.
You know, and the light that this case should shine on that process, because, see, that process is the one that disallows fair and rightful treatment. And what we have to realize is that the system is as it's been. And we now have to be able to address matters like this and to be able to start lobbying for the change necessary to correct it. Because this right here is such an egregious act. You know, the fair and effective assistance of counsel is something that everybody deserves the right to.
Your whole case, when you're charged with a crime, depends on the competency of the lawyer that's representing you in the court.
Yes.
In most cases, you probably got criminal defendants that can articulate their situation a lot better than the lawyers can.
Yes.
But they won't let you talk.
Yes.
Everything that has to be said has to go through the lawyer.
Yes.
If the lawyer is distracted, he's got other cases on his mind. Sometimes he's trying to try two or three cases in one day.
Right.
You know, so everything that needs to be done does not get said. You know, and some public defenders, I hate to say this, but some public, they just plain don't care. You know, only thing I want to do is just run you through these courts,
right,
and go through the process and everything, and whatever happens, happens. And that's pretty much the attitude they got when you go to trial. You know, whatever happens, happens. I'll put on whatever defense you have. And a lot of times you have opposition with the public defenders. They don't even want to try the case the way it needs to be tried.
Right.
If you didn't do a crime that you've been committed, that you have been accused of committing, you should know more about your case than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a lot of times the things that need to be put in front of the court, they don't get there because the lawyers didn't take time to adequately prepare the case. Now, let me ask you this. What stage is your nephew's case in now?
Right now they have where it's getting ready to come before the judge. There's two parties here. There's Vivi and there's Garen Briggs, both of my nephews. And their case is getting ready to come up before one of the courts. And what we're asking for now is, we calling it the Free Vivi campaign. And we asking for everyone out there that's listening, if you are listening to this, to reach out to the prosecutor's office, Gene Peters Bakers. I'm sorry, and to show your support for this, because it's about to come up, and we need the prosecutor's office to render their influence on this case to get it resolved. And I say that. To your last point, had the public defender raised the proper objectives in these cases, the plea bargain would have been accepted, and it would have been, because that was the other thing, the plea bargain process was breached.
Right.
So all of these processes that was breached as it pertains to this case should serve as the model, I would say, for previous cases going forward and set a precedent.
Well, explain to us what you mean by the plea bargain process being breached.
Okay, there was a plea bargain that was presented, and I don't want to say it incorrectly, but I just say that the plea bargain, had they realized the ability of that plea bargain at the in the time, manner that they was it was presented, they would have accepted it.
Well, what was the plea bargain?
That's why I say it was. I believe that the amount of time that they spent already, it would have been served. They'd be out right now. They'd be out. So, you know, with that being said, the fact that they've served the time that would have allotted, that even more so says free them and let them move on into the next phase of their life.
I want to caution anybody who happens to be incarcerated or facing criminal charges right now. I want to enlighten you about something. The best time to try to beat your case is before it goes to trial or at your trial. And you need to do everything you can, put whatever kind of pressure you have to on the lawyer, on the courts, to make sure all of your evidence gets heard. Because once you have been convicted, nobody in the that has any responsibility to evaluate your case fairly, they're just not interested. Once you're in there, you're in there, and it's almost a hopeless situation. Now, that's not to say that you shouldn't try to get back out of prison. Jean Peters Baker has not been very open-minded to trying to step up, even in cases where she knows injustices have occurred. We have tried, you know, me and other people that I've been working with, we have tried this time and time again to get her. All they have to do is just go in the courtroom and confess to the charges and say, well, we don't think that we have a case anymore. You know, in light of the new evidence, she's not open to that, you know, and most prosecutors are not. They don't want to be proven that they're wrong. They, you know, because that then their credibility is on the line. You got one case where you can say, well, you did this in this case.
Yeah.
Why didn't you do another? I mean, there are hundreds of cases. This is what the public does not understand. This is not to say that we should not go to Jean Peters Baker and we should not try to prevail upon her to try to do justice in this man's case. But there are hundreds of cases. There may be thousands right here in Missouri,
really?
Where there have been serious acts of misconduct, gross incompetence as far as being represented by the attorneys or the public defenders, and incompetence ain't just limited to public defenders. You have paid lawyers out here that you give money to go into court and represent you properly, and many of them are incompetent.
Wow.
You know, you know, and I want to try to dispel this notion that people have that if you got a paid lawyer that you're going to get public defenders, on the average, they do just about as well as the paid lawyers do.
Wow.
You know, this is what a lot of people don't know.
No, I didn't know that.
The most crucial time, do not sit in the county jail and waste your time watching TV, playing dominoes, checkers, and chess, and all the other things that you do. You need to have your mind on your case, because if you think that a lawyer is going to go in there and try to defend, I mean, there are some good, I don't want to trash good lawyers. You got good public defenders. They're not interested in whether or not they're able to get paid the amount of money that they deserve to be paid. Some lawyers will actually go in court and they will fight tooth and nail to try to get their clients exonerated if they are innocent. You know, but you cannot rely on that. Your best defense is trying to organize your own case, know everything that needs to be done in your case, and try to make sure that your lawyer is doing what needs to be done. And I suspect that's probably maybe some of the things that took place with your nephew, him being a person that had never been in trouble before and everything.
Right.
And he probably thought, well, the lawyer's going to do what needs to be done. He relied on that, and that's why he's in prison.
Yeah, and to that point, has worked very diligently since being in there because one thing that in reading that report you have in front of you, you know, I was really amazed because, see, this is, you know, by the fact that it was so close, you know, that I'm realizing things that I didn't even know. I did not know. Just like what you said just a minute ago about Jean Peters Baker's. I don't know that side of her.
Right.
See, I know her, and from our conversations, and you know, I know a whole other side.
Right.
So it just says that because of the fact that we as a society and we as a community have sat back and allowed these systems that are in place that are injustice all around the board. You go from the criminal justice system to the construction field to the foster homes to the all these different inadequacies that are taking place in our community. And it's just a matter of us now being able to address it and be diligent in our pursuit. And, you know, I'm excited for change. I believe that it's time for change, that local and state government, federal government is ready for change. Trump's even calling for change. So let's get together, everybody, and let's make a change.
I have one more question I want to ask you, and we don't have very much time. Knowing the way that things have turned out, if you had had any knowledge or had thought that there was any possibility that things could go as terribly wrong as they have, would you have still encouraged your nephew to turn himself in?
You know, I wouldn't have. And that's sad to say, because I'm an advocate for that.
Right.
But, you know, now that I know, but I would say this, in my heart, I always know you have to do what's right. So, yes, I would have. But I would have pursued his innocence a lot harder. I wouldn't have waited, like you said, I wouldn't have waited till the trial was over to pursue this. I would have pursued it more diligent in the beginning, because I would have had some type of inclination that it was going to go wrong. Nothing could go wrong in this case.
And on that note, I'm sorry to say that we have to end the interview right now. We will stay on top of this situation to the best of our ability and try to keep the public informed of any changing events that occur during the process of this man trying to be win his exoneration.
Now the calendar for the week of April 22nd. Representative Brandon Ellington, Strategic Workforce Development, GYRL, and My Brother's Keeper's 4th Annual Job Fair will be held Thursday, April 25th, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Brush Creek Community Center, 3801 Emmanuel Cleaver II Boulevard, KCMO. There will be over 20 ex-offender-friendly employers at present. Come ready to be interviewed and with work history. For more information, email brandon.ellington@house.mo.gov or call the office at 573-751-3129. UMKC Law School and Code for KC are sponsoring an Expungement Day, Saturday, April 27th, from 8 to 11:30 a.m. at the Morning Star Missionary Baptist Church, 2411 East 27th Street, KCMO. To sign up, go to info.umkc.edu/clearmyrecord. For information on how to qualify, call 816-200-2871 or go to clear-my-record@codeforkc.org. The case of Ricky Kidd is similar in some respects to the case of Victor Vickers, Jr., in that Ricky has proven his innocence in court and his freedom is being denied by a procedural miscue. You can attend an evidentiary hearing on Ricky's case starting tomorrow, April 23rd, at 9 a.m. at the Daviess County Courthouse, 102 North Main Street, number 6, Gallatin, Missouri. This is a unique educational court event for everyday citizens to see how exonerations are fought and achieved. This hearing is scheduled for, but may not take up to 4 days to conclude. You are invited to attend any part of the hearing you can. Stay tuned for Jaws of Justice Radio next week when we talk with Ricky Kidd and his supporters in his effort to be exonerated. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Up next is Margo and her guest.
Andrew Couples is an award-winning architect based in Los Angeles who specializes in the field of justice architecture. That is, the planning and design of court, correctional, and detention facilities. He has designed more than 100 million square feet of buildings in 45 states and abroad, and is credited with inspiring in his peers and in the public a greater understanding of how the built environment affects the lives and the future prospects of the incarcerated. Mr. Couples' work has been profiled in 3 documentary films. He speaks regularly at conferences around the world about the architecture of redemption and how the environment can play a key role in the rehabilitation, healing, and transformation of individuals and communities. Mr. Couples, welcome to the program.
Yes.
Let me begin by asking, before learning of your work, I don't think I'd ever given any thought to prison architecture. Tell us about the impact of design on correctional and detention facilities and what you think defines good architecture in that particular milieu.
Well, I think I would start that by talking about what we believe, which is that as architects, we can elevate the human experience through design, and that we really need to focus on healing, equity, and transformation. Years and years and years ago, the Federal Bureau of Prisons actually took a really strong lead in creating better environments. In fact, one of the prisons in Upper New York was actually built as housing initially for the Olympics, and it was more about a campus. It was more about creating opportunities for individual freedom, for a bit more control of your own life. And I think that the key issue is to recognize what you're basically doing is creating a city within a secure perimeter. But within that city, providing opportunities for people to actually realize themselves. We kind of take the approach you cannot rehabilitate anybody, but you can provide opportunities for self-rehabilitation, self-realization. The other thing that I think as you look at evaluating what makes a good environment is remembering we've got to provide just as good of an environment for the staff that have to work there, because many of them will spend more time there than some of the population will. So it really comes down to a combination of thinking about how you provide an environment for people to have self-realization what they can be.
Well, and in terms of doing that, how do you create opportunities for self-realization via design?
Well, I think part of it is moving away from the notion of very, very large group living to smaller groups. On the detention and correction side, we typically look for, you know, housing areas of no more than 48 to a maximum of 64 people. Within the housing area, providing opportunities to reduce the apparent density, in other words, for people to have some personal space, be able to move from each other. On the juvenile side, we're really focused on groupings of 8 to 12, very, very small groups. The other part of this, there was a book written years and years ago called The New Red Barn, which the basic idea was that a good approach to operations can function in any facility. It really comes down to how design reinforces the staff's ability to manage through interpersonal relations. We try to move away from the notion of design being based totally on custody and control to recognize that the folks that end up in our jails or in our prisons or in our juvenile detention facilities are under our care, and that we really have a responsibility for care as part of custody.
And how much progress have you seen in shifting from that philosophy of custody and control to care and custody? Has that had a widespread impact, do you think, yet?
I think so, and I think it's gaining more and more momentum every day. One of the things we deal with a lot in planning and design for detention and corrections is the fact that our criminal justice system, unfortunately, has become, and I used to say the social service of last resort, but now it's becoming the social service of first resort in dealing with mental health issues, in dealing with homelessness, in dealing with a lot of issues which end up clogging our system. And I think as we've especially focused on mental health and providing better environments for mental health treatment as part of this process, the notions of biophilic design, introducing nature and natural light, natural rhythms, being able to actually see outside. I mean, if you look at some of the older, really old facilities, the old linear facilities actually had abundant natural light. The old telephone poles. At some point, we moved to a system of control rooms trying to see everything, and everything became internalized. Today, we really focus on how we bring natural light, natural environment, and create an environment which more respects the human condition.
Well, I know you've spoken about how good design can reduce violence in prison and lead to better outcomes for inmates. Talk, if you will, about the kinds of processes and practices that can improve outcomes for people in prisons, juvenile detention centers, and even mental health centers.
Well, I think that the basic approach is the same for all. It deals with providing opportunities. It deals with smaller group living. It deals with a basic respect for the human condition. Start with the notion that people are incarcerated for either two reasons. One, on the detention side, because they pose a risk to society or to themselves or to flight. Or on the incarceration side, the incarceration is the punishment. You're not sent there to be further punished. So providing a more normative environment, juvenile facilities, we try to treat the school, the gymnasium, the cafeteria, but during the day, you're actually participating in a program as if you're not in a secure facility. Smaller group treatment is key to this. Staff that's trained in interpersonal relationships and in intervention to prevent incident rather than react to it is really key. And we like to also think about the notion of peripheral vision, that everybody always has an idea of what's going on, which gives you a bigger sense of security. You know, the one thing that gets lost in all this is that while we build these facilities many times as A, punishment, and B, because we think we're keeping the public safe, we need to also think about how we provide a safe environment for the people that are in our care.
Mr. Couples, can you speak up just a little bit?
Sure.
I understand that there's been a request that you speak a little bit louder. I was unaware until recently that there was a specialty called justice architecture. A letter you referenced mentioned that architects who practice in that field often ask themselves the question, are they supporting a system that is unfair or unethical by designing buildings that imprison people? You've obviously answered no to that question. Was that answer always obvious to you, or did you come to it over a period of time?
Well, I think I've come to it over a period of time, and I think most recently we focused in our practice. We do a lot of front-end planning work. In fact, we're starting a project now where the client wanted to talk about how they look at what they need in terms of a new courthouse and a new jail. And our approach to the project was, before we decide what, we need to understand the why and who are we serving and what are we doing and are there opportunities for other ways to deal with that population, from crisis intervention by the police as opposed to looking at the jail as a first place to take somebody, providing an alternate program, prosecutorial diversion by saying, if you participate in these programs, we will drop the charges, mental health courts. The biggest issue, I think, is we have a tendency to always look at jails and prisons as if they're the problem, when quite frankly, they're at the back end of the system. Everything that starts with law enforcement on the street, through the courts, and in many times our jails and our prisons are simply the receiver of other decisions. And it's really imperative when you look at planning for the future that you think about what is driving the system and what could be done differently.
And have you come up with some answers to that question, what can be done differently?
Well, again, I think there's a whole range of options. Most of it deals with having a broader view of what the responsibility of society is in terms of social services. Interestingly, there's a film out now called The Public about that Emilio Estevez did about homelessness in the Cincinnati library and people taking it over for a night because there's no place to go. There was just an editorial recently that again ties that to the fact that we do not provide the level of social services and alternatives that we need to. There's a book, if your listeners are interested, called Insane, the criminal treatment of folks with mental illness and how we use our jail and prison system for that. It gives an example in San Antonio, Bexar County, where the police, along with the county, created a crisis intervention team because they found it was easier for the police to take somebody to the jail than it was the emergency room, just in terms of the turnaround time to get in and get out. So they created a crisis intervention center. They schooled the police in crisis intervention and de-escalating situations and gave them an alternative to simply arresting somebody for the same kinds of homeless, you know, sleeping in front of somebody's store, urinating on the wall, whatever. You know, the minor kinds of things which are more mental health and society issues that were ending up getting people clogging up the criminal justice system when they needed a different kind of response. Those things have been very successful across the country.
Mr. Couples, I know you've been active in the field of justice architecture for over 30 years. Can you talk a little bit about what motivated you to get into that particular area of architecture?
I can make that a short story or a long story. I mean, it basically came when I was in college. I had a couple professors that talked about the fact that architecture is an art, a science, and a social science, that we can actually make a difference. And I wasn't really interested in doing office buildings that didn't have an impact. And I got exposed to doing justice architecture years and years ago when the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration was providing assistance to counties at the first cycle of conditions of confinement legislation. And I gravitated to that because I truly believe we can make a difference. In fact, the DLR group, the firm I'm with now, our watchword is to elevate the human experience through design. And we really believe we can make a difference through the quality of architecture, the quality of environment we provide, not just for the folks that come in contact with the justice system, but for the folks that work within it, and provide them a better environment for what they do. Many times we like to talk about the fact that staff that work in these facilities serve a life sentence 8 hours a day.
Am I wrong in thinking that you had some personal experience that played a role in your selecting this field?
Well, not directly personal, but I think if you really look, virtually everybody in the country has had somebody in their family that's come afoul of the justice system. And I've also had the opportunity, I think, in my career, because I've been doing this so long, to see some of the really older facilities and what has led to, you know, a lot of the federal litigation and conditions of confinement, which led to saying we need to treat human beings more like human beings.
This is Margo Patterson with the Jaws of Justice, and if you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Andrew Couples, a architect in the field of justice architecture. I want to ask you about your efforts helping state and local officials comply with the Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. When laws in the late 1980s made it easier for inmates to sue for deplorable conditions, it opened up a floodgate of litigation filed by human rights groups as well as inmates. You've worked in the past to devise solutions that would not only result in the settlement of litigation claims, but would improve facilities and establish standards to govern them for the future. Can you give some examples of your work in this area? What was your most challenging assignment in terms of that work?
Well, I think the most challenging assignment many times is to get officials to realize that what they believe they're doing, is right in terms of finance and everything else, is not necessarily right in how they're treating people. I remember actually being in a governor's office, and the response when we talked about privacy and how we treat people, because this was a system where people basically were marched in groups and naked into group showers, and so they just need more soap. So many times in those days, you were really dealing with trying to move the needle just a bit. Today, the needle's moved a lot further. There's still some conditions of confinement suits going on. There's a couple states right now I know the federal government's looking at for that. But in general, there's a much more acceptance of the notion that these are people we're responsible for. And you know, one of the major studies we're doing now, one of the biggest issues of concern to the officials is the fact that they've had a high rate of suicide. And what can they do to change that, both operationally and in terms of design? The conditions of confinement has all federal litigation was a bit contracted because there were some laws passed by Congress to start to pull back the courts in terms of their ability to do that. But there still is a lot of activity from the Justice Department in looking at what's going on in facilities to assure that we meet basic human dignity requirements. Most recently, the federal government passed the PREA, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, which really sets some standards for privacy, for concern. And again, we kind of translate that into, it's not just about meeting standards, it's about having respect for basic human dignity of the people that are in our facilities.
How can you create more a greater sense of privacy for inmates in prison?
Very simple. If you've ever been in a facility, you'll see that toilets and showers are left open. You can walk up to the room, the door of a room, and look in and see somebody using the facilities. We look at how we place furniture, how we do privacy partitions, how we provide a little bit more of a sense that you have privacy in the facility.
Here's something written about you. His prison, quote, his prison and detention environments, like churches and sacred spaces, have become places to repent, to seek redemption, to recover, and to heal, end quote. I'm wondering what ideals or people have inspired you in your work, and I'm wondering how contact with the imprisoned and mentally ill has altered you.
I got to tell you, when you walk through a facility, and obviously I'm an architect, so I have a fairly good lifestyle, upper middle class, et cetera, but you walk through facilities and you see what the vast number of folks are that we're dealing with that haven't had the opportunities that everybody else have. It's very heart-wrenching. And then you think about, you walk through facilities and you look at how we've designed them in the past to basically be so hard, because the sense is that then we don't have to maintain, we reduce our maintenance costs. If the acoustics are bad, the quality of life is bad, TV's blaring, there's been articles about, even from especially on the prison side, that people don't want to watch television all day. They want to have activities. A lot of what we try to do is to provide the space for that, but there has been a sense, across the country, especially when we went through the huge recession recently and things had to be cut, that access to college programs, access to education, access to programs to fill the day that were meaningful were cut back. And I really think that that's the thing that resonates the most, is how you provide activities for somebody every day that are meaningful in terms of life. And I had a friend who was a director of corrections who was a real advocate for reentry. And one of the things he said to me is, remember, we lock people up for 3, 5, 10, 15 years, control every aspect of their life every day, from what time they get up, to what time they eat, to when they can shower, to when they can use the phone, to when they can visit. And then suddenly we expect them to be, to take charge of their own lives. So we spend a lot of time, especially on the prison side, talking about how we move the needle from total control to a little bit more self-determination over time, so people actually are running their own lives. We're just doing a competition for a juvenile facility where we're talking about putting private laundries in housing units so that kids learn to do their own clothes. You know, there's basic skills that many of us learn that many people have never really been exposed to.
If you had to name one or two projects that you're most proud of, what would they be?
Oh, geez. Probably my next one, because obviously we always try to improve what we're doing. But I've done two juvenile facilities in the country, one called New Beginnings in Laurel, Maryland, which was done for the director at the time was Vinnie Schiraldi, who actually moved the entire system from one of incarceration to one of diversion. And we replaced a multi-hundred bed facility with a 60-bed facility targeted at programs and growth. And just recently I worked with L.A. County on a project called Campus Kilpatrick, which was to move from the notion of a camp for committed kids to a campus and something which was more akin to an open environment and program driven. I think they've been two really good projects that have had a major impact on youth and recidivism. And, you know, if the goal, if you think about it, is to really to take a youth and keep them from getting into the adult system. And for every one of those you can do, it's a major success.
One comment I'd make
is, for your listeners, is everybody talks about recidivism and always talks about the high rate of recidivism. I think instead we should start to focus on the success rate. And if we move that success rate from 30 to 35 to 40%, that's still a major impact on society.
Well, Mr. Couples, thank you so much for talking to us on the program today.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following was recorded in Tampa, Florida at the 13th National Clinical Conference on Cannabis Therapeutics.
Laura Logano, Integrative Clinical Nutritionist and Holistic Cannabis Practitioner. I wrote a book called The CBD Oil Miracle, which is really not just about CBD, but about this ancient plant. Hemp, according to the U.S. Farm Bill, is less than 0.3% THC, and what we're identifying as marijuana is over 0.3% THC. So THC is the cannabinoid, one of the compounds in cannabis, that provides its intoxicating effect. A lot of people refer to CBD as non-psychoactive, and that's not really true, because CBD is psychoactive. That's why it works. That's why it works to quell anxiety. That's why it works for PTSD. That's why it works in depression. It is one of the compounds that really helps to modulate a lot of immune function. It works as an antioxidant, but it does work in combination with the other compounds in the plant, what we call the entourage effect. And, you know, essentially, that's also the way other plants work. You know, when we start taking out components in plants, it just doesn't work as well. We see that plants work when you eat a whole plant, and cannabis is really no different. So, in fact, when people are looking for a product, a CBD oil, they typically want to look for something that is full spectrum, meaning it contains the full spectrum of the cannabinoids and often other plant materials, which would include the terpenes. Nobody ever talks about the terpenes. And just to give people an idea of what is a terpene, take your fingernail, run it over the outside of a citrus fruit, and you'll get that beautiful fragrant smell. That's the terpene, the essential oil, if you will. And terpenes interact with the cannabinoids in the cannabis plant for different effects. So, for example, limonene is a terpene that's often found in the cannabis plant, and limonene is very uplifting. There are some people, however, who cannot tolerate limonene, and you will see typically those people are what I would call, more type A people. And it's not necessarily because why are they a type A person? They typically have some sort of a genetic mutation. It's not a bad thing. It's called a SNP, a single nucleotide polymorphism, where limonene really doesn't match with their genetic health.
I'm Dean at drugtruth.net.
Sitting here in my problem. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.